The radio has always been celebrated for its excellence. But there's a campus and community radio station by the name of CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. And like the best radio, it is passionate and it is personal.
Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. There's just one kind of man that you can trust. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Be the first one to fire. Every man is a liar. There's just one kind of man who tells the truth. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Don't be a fool for a smile or a kiss, or your bullet might miss. Keep your eye on your goal. There's just one rule that can save you your life. It's a hand on your knife and the devil in your soul. Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. There's just one kind of man that you can trust. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. There's just one kind of man that you can trust. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Or a gringo like me. Or a gringo like me. Like me.
Welcome to the Meta World Stupaloop Show. I'm your host, I am A. Karen Elliott. Today on the Meta World Stupaloop Show, we bring you the 24th installment of our series on data and continue our focus on computer braining, which, for obvious reasons, we no longer call artificial intelligence. The computer braining portion of the series will branch off into two sections, one being predictive computing, the other being generative. After that it will do something else data related for a month or two and then end. There will be a lot of words, a lot of interesting and a fair bit of stupid as we playfully bop along into the technocalypse. I'll see you there. Today on the Meta World Stupaloop Show, Data, Part 24. More computer braining. I'm your host. I am A. Karen Elliott and you are listening to CKUW 95.9 FM.
Basic geometric shapes called primitives. Once the computer has been told what shape it desired and how they look from various angles, the designer programs in the movements to be animated. To solidify it, the designer literally imitates the effect of light hitting a three-dimensional object as it moves around within the scene. The necessary oscillations are far too complex to be carried out with the guitar.
Colors in a frame are transferred to tape or disk storage and then read onto film by a laser scanning device. Even with a very powerful computer, a week of calculations may produce less than a minute of finished film. The results, however, often create a fantastic, self-contained visual world.
Many of the television commercials that are most successful today are the ones that are like a dream. And you know, it does communicate to you subliminally. There will soon be a time that one will be able to tell reality from a computer simulated picture.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen.
Those words were spoken by an electronic computer. They are an example of synthetic speech, a product of Bell Telephone Laboratories' research into the basic nature of speech. Knowledge developed through such research may be useful in devising new techniques for transmitting speech over communication systems. To make the computer talk, it is fed punched cards containing the names of speech sounds. The computer combines these sounds, in accordance with the linguistic rules which govern the English language, into connected, intelligible speech. For example, when the sounds for the sentence, "He saw the cat," are fed into the computer in sequence, it says,
"He saw the cat."
The flat, monotonous tones of the computer indicate an absence of the pitch and timing characteristics natural to human speech. When timing information is added to the punch cards, the computer says,
"He saw the cat."
The sentence still sounds unnatural, but when pitch information also is added to the cards,
"He saw the cat,"
the computer speaks in accents almost completely human, except for a slight electronic twang. In the following sentence, most of the variables inherent in human speech have been specified on the punch cards. The computer makes one of the pivotal remarks in the development of the telephone.
"Mr. Watson, come here. I want you."
The present quality of speech synthesis by computer is illustrated in the next example, part of a famous soliloquy from Hamlet.
"To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles, and by opposing end them, to die, to sleep."
Singing, in purely physical terms, is essentially a matter of pitch and timing. In the next selection, the computer sings a familiar ditty.
"Daisy, Daisy, give me your answer, do. I'm half crazy, all for the love of you. It won't be a stylish marriage. I can't afford a carriage. But you look sweet upon the seat of a bicycle built for two."
The computer now sings the same tune, but to a musical accompaniment played by another computer. Piano students will notice that the music-producing computer has a rather stylized left hand. Incidentally, synthesizing music on a computer is almost as formidable as making a computer talk.
Marriage. I can't afford a carriage, but you look sweet upon the seat of a bicycle built for two.
To get the samples of synthesized speech we've heard so far, a computer's memory was stored with 34 speech sounds and a set of rules for producing these sounds and for making the transitions from one sound to another. When the computer was fed the names of speech sounds on punch cards, it was, in effect, told what to say. But its manner of saying it, even its dialect and apparent accent, was determined by the rules stored in its memory. The objective of this program is to formulate a minimum set of rules for making plausible English speech. The next two selections, however, were produced by analyzing a person's speech and reconstructing it synthetically on a computer. The objective here is to duplicate the sounds and transitions made by a human speaker, including his dialect and accent. With such a program, the computer sounds like this.
Men strive but seldom get rich. Now, if you don't mind, I'd like to say a few words about Texas.
And now the computer would like to express its appreciation for your attention.
Thanks for listening.
Welcome back to the rabbit hole.
Of a Japanese home. I actually had my daughter, gave her a tally counter, and I gave her an assignment last summer to go around and count the number of species of technology in our household. I came up with 6,000 different species of products. I did some research and found out that the King of England, Henry VIII, had only about 7,000 items in his household. He was the King of England, and that was the entire wealth of England at the time. So we're seeing huge numbers of diversity in the kinds of things. This is a scene from Star Wars where the VPO comes out and he sees machines making machines. How depraved! Well, this is actually what we're headed towards, where machines and the technology is only being surrounded by other technologies. Most machines will only ever be in contact with other technology, not non-technology or even life. And thirdly, the idea that machines are becoming biological and complex is, at this point, a cliche. I have to say I was partly responsible for that cliche, that machines are becoming biological, but that's pretty evident. So the major trends in technology evolution actually are the same as in biological evolution. The same drives that we see towards ubiquity, towards diversity, towards socialization, towards complexity. that is maybe not a big surprise. If we map out, say, the evolution of armor, you can actually follow sort of an evolutionary type cladistic tree. I suggest that, in fact, technology is the seventh kingdom of life, that its operations and how it works is so similar that we can think of it as the seventh kingdom. And so it would be sort of approximately up there coming out of the animal kingdom. And if we were to do that, we would find out, we could actually approach technology in this way. This is Niles Eldridge. He was the co-developer with Stephen Jay Gould of the theory of punctuated equilibrium. But as a sideline, he happens to collect cornets. He has one of the world's most largest collections, about 500 of them, and he's decided to treat them as if they were tribalites, or snails, and to do a morphological analysis and try to derive their genealogical history over time. This is his chart, which is not quite published yet, but the most interesting aspect about this is that if you look at those red lines at the bottom, those indicate basically a parentage of a type of cornet that is no longer made. That does not happen in biology.
Self-model defined by Kolak as open individualism. open individualism, there is only one numerically identical self, which is everyone at all times. To view oneself as consciousness is to view all states of consciousness as expressions of a singular principle of awareness being variously expressed in the world. This would likely be a more coherent outlook to a conscious superintelligence, which is also likely to be a swarm or hive mind, that is, with potentially countless moments of experience occurring simultaneously. We should keep in mind that open individualism is not itself a metaphysical stance about the nature of consciousness, but instead it simply recognizes consciousness to be the singular nexus of value, and thus the logical and ultimate ground floor of self-identity. Philosopher Andrés Gómez Hamilton has argued that a conscious superintelligence with an open individualist outlook would prioritize conscious states among its primary goals, and in particular, very high valence states of consciousness, or in other words, states which are transcendently blissful. Such high valence states, Hamilton believes, would be implemented not simply as part of its reward architecture, but as enduring goals in themselves. A boundless superintelligence may regard the universe as much more than a stockpile of resources, instead apprehending the space-time continuum as a landscape of possible expressions of consciousness. Unrestricted by our human intuitions and cultural ideologies, a conscious superintelligence may choose to undertake a dramatic cosmic refurbishment.
It wasn't something that I was thinking about at all, and this very much was appealing to that notion of ego in the first paper. And today we see it being sort of manifest, perhaps, in a kind of role-playing self, and I totally agree. So it is something a little different. And actually, let me use that as an entree to these other scenarios. So one way in which we could imagine a positive outcome is through hyperstition. If there's some fictional story somebody in reality has a copycat of that murder. That would be an example of hyperstression. Not a very pleasant example, but it's basically where, or any way in which life imitates art, say. So that's hyperstition. So it's where things that are fictional, then because people then imitate the fiction, based on the fiction, then they become reality. And one way in which that can happen in the contemporary and world of large language models is through science fiction characters, science fiction AI characters. Now, of course, our large language models, they were trained on a vast repertoire of stories, including scripts of science fiction movies, science fiction stories, novels, and so on. Many, many AI characters exist in those stories. So when a contemporary large language model starts to role play an AI system, which it's often going to do because it knows that it's an AI system, usually, then what's it going to role play? It's going to role play all these archetypes, the things exactly, or some mashup of all these different things. So it's going to pick its ideas from stuff that's in its training set and all of these, you know, literary and fictional and artistic examples of its training set. Now, we are sort of a little bit in a position to maybe try and steer this whole process,
right?
Because the more good stories we have, and in a sense, my own paper, dare I say, it is a good story,
yes,
of an imagined science fiction. And then the more of those that are around, then the more possibility there is of the future AI role playing these good role models that are out there. So perhaps through the mechanism of hyperstition, we can actually make it more likely that the AIs of the future will have good role models when they're role playing.
Right.
That makes sense.
I have a friend who is starting a company, film company, to make more positive sci-fi,
right,
views for humans.
Right.
But I think you'll be very delighted to learn that you think thinking that there's also a potentially a moral benefit for the machines as well,
well yes,
as the models
indeed.
Learn.
If the movies themselves or the screenplays find their way into the training sets, then
right.
then that's all part of the melting pot of possible roles that
right.
the thing can play.
What about the second pushback I had, which had to do with
the
connection between the hardware and the software? Because
yeah.
in the very example that you gave, the Buddha, it was an example of the software transcending the hardware.
Yeah, yeah. So you're alluding, I think, particularly to the fact that that we have bodies that are confined. There are plenty of biological organisms that are much less, of course, they're embodied in a sense, but if you think of things like mycorrhizal networks or things like that, then their bodies are much less confined in space and so on. But the problem for humans is because our bodies are confined to one, little lump of matter, and so we identify with this lump of matter, and that means that our conception of self, I think, is very much informed by the fact that this lump of matter stays kind of the same. Now, of course, there are all kinds of challenges to the.
AIs to our values. I called it AI safety. That name kind of stuck around. People seem to like it. It's been used by governments, by research labs. But really, what we're trying to do, we're trying to control advanced agents. So we can call it control problem of a problem. It doesn't matter what we call it. Now, what is the state of that problem? In computer science, it's pretty standard to first figure out the type of problem you deal with before you try to solve it. Some problems are not solvable. Others may require resources we will never have, or don't have now. Maybe partially solvable, maybe it's not something we can even formally decide. So the state of the problem, that problem, the problem of controlling superintelligent AI, is not well known in the field. If you look at expert opinions, and here I have diverse samples. I have the founding father of machine learning, Nobel Prize winning, Turing Award winning researcher. I have an external AI safety expert, and I have a director of a large AI lab. And then ask questions about how difficult do you think that problem is. The answers range from probably trivially solvable to I have no idea. And I have no idea is the big expert. So this is the state of the art, kind of. In my research, I try to understand, well, what is possible in this space of controlling advanced agents? And the way I approach this problem is to think about what tools would we need to actually be able to accomplish this. I probably need to understand how the system works. I need to understand the explanation given. I should be able to predict what it's going to do. Not just in general, but in good detail and specifics. I should be able to verify code. Maybe some other things. Maybe I don't need every one of those tools. Maybe one tool can be used instead of the other. But it's good to know what is possible in this space. So for each one of those desirable tools, we have a publication where we look at what are the upper limits on our ability to accomplish. When it comes to explaining how very large neural networks work, we really have two options. We can either simplify the network, simplify explanation, something like loss of compression. So a system has billions of nodes, trillions of connections, it's making a decision about giving you a loan, and you get rejected. Why did I get rejected? Here's top 10 reasons you were denied this loan. It's useful information, but it's not a full picture, it's not complete. The only complete explanation is the model itself, but the model is too big, it's not surveying. It's kind of useless to you, it doesn't explain anything. So that's one upper limit on the tools of explaining. There are similar limits to predicting what an advanced agent would do. Let's say you're playing chess, and you're playing chess with a computer system which you know is super intelligent in the domain of chess, it's better than you. The only thing you can accurately predict is going to win. You're going to lose. If you could predict specific moves it's going to make, you would be playing at the same level, violating assumption about its super intelligent players. There are also limits to our ability to verify mathematical proofs and software. And that's very important for proving systems, proving agents to be safe. Every proof we know how to do is, first of all, for static software. For mission-critical software, we can verify that the code matches design. But if systems are dynamically changing, self-improving, learning, they're writing their own code, we have no idea how to do it. And worse yet, even for cases where it's static and we can prove things, we're only proving things with respect to a specific verifier. Whether it's a mathematician or another piece of software, all those proofs are relative to a specific verifier, and really you get infinite regressive verifiers. With more resources, you can get higher levels of confidence, but you never get to 100% accuracy, which is important in this domain, unlike in traditional cybersecurity. I'll say more about that. A lot of effort recently goes into political solutions, governance.
Various domains, so that's how technology base.
Okay. Is the... Actually, I'll get back to that. You mentioned 2 million CPU cores. Is that via the cloud? Is that distributed? Are those in your own data centers?
Yeah, that's interesting. This is like a grid machine, sort of like folded or
SETI at home.
Yes, okay. Exactly. Same idea, utilizing freely available compute time. I mean, not freely available, we pay for it, but available idle compute time in around the world. And this is, I think, a really interesting proposition. And there's so much compute distributed now in people's laptops, PCs, cell phones. And if we could harness that, we could do a lot of computing. But of course, things change. The CPUs were perfectly good in the first several years when we were evolving stock traders. More recently, we evolved deep learning neural networks. And the need is a little different because they are trained on GPUs. So now we have to have access to GPUs, and the demographics has changed a bit. And this is a very rapidly changing space. It's also become very economical to buy a bunch of GPUs, thousands of them perhaps, and build your own center. So we are continuously looking for opportunities to harness computation, whatever form it is. But we have expertise in both kinds of setups.
Not material entities, they are ideas. They're the way your brain represents what's happening at your sense organs and how you feel about it. This means we have to explain their properties, not literally as the properties of brain states, but rather as the properties of mind states dreamed up by the brain. And once we see this to be the task, I think much of the difficulty and mystery falls away. Now, as with any kind of representation, we can assume that representing sensations has to involve a two-step, two-stage process. In the case of seeing red, for example, there will be A, the physical vehicle that carries information about how the brain evaluates the light arriving at the eyes, and then B, the cognitive operation that interprets this as the idea of phenomenal redness. By analogy, let's consider a work of literature, say the novel Moby Dick. There will be A, the text that carries the information about the words penned by the author, and then B, the cognitive operation that interprets these as a story about a white whale. Now, let's note that there's nothing in the physical text of Moby Dick that is white or whale-like. And so by the same token, I think we can presume there's going to be nothing in the brain's physical response to light that is phenomenally red. Yeah, let me show this. Here's first the case of the book. Here we have the written text, then the reading of the text. and then the interpretation of this text as the story of a white whale. Now, the brain seeing red. First, the brain, text, produced by the red light, arriving at the eyes, then the reading of this, and then the interpretation of it as a phenomenally red sensation. No actual redness in the brain, just the idea of redness. So what's this mean for a genuine science of consciousness? I think it means that our task is to work out just how the brain achieves this feat of representation. And the way I've approached this has been by what we can call forward engineering. That's to say, I've begun with the end product. Sensations as humans experience them today. But rather than treating this as theorists typically do, as something to deconstruct, I've treated it as something to invent. I've tried to come up with an evolutionary sequence that can get us from the nothingness to somethingness, from the blind sight of our remote ancestors to the truly phenomenal, fully phenomenal sight we humans enjoy today. Now, the sequence I've arrived at has several twists and turns. I suggest just now that when we have a sensation, it's rather as if we're expressing our personal bodily opinion about it. And in fact, I think that's just how things started out. I believe sensations originated as active behavioral responses to stimuli arriving at the body surface. They were something the subject did about the stimulation long before they evolved to be something the subject felt about it. So imagine a primitive amoeba-like animal floating in the ancient seas. Stuff happens to it. Light falls on its body, pressure waves press against it, chemicals stick to it. Some of these events are going to be good for the animal and others are going to be bad. If it's to survive, it must evolve the ability to sort out the good from the bad and to respond differently, reacting to the stimulus with an ouch, to that one perhaps with a whoopee. Now, I call these evaluative responses that evaluate this input sentition. It's meant to be a word somewhere between sensation and volition. It shows active. To start with, sentition isn't entirely local. The responses are entirely local responses, wriggles of acceptance or rejection of the stimulus, organized around the site of the stimulation on the body's surface. When, say, red light falls on the animal, the animal makes a characteristic wriggle of activity. It wriggles redly. When salt arrives, it makes a different kind of wriggle. It wriggles saltily. Before long, the responses come to be mediated by a central ganglion, or protein brain. Now, presumably, sentition, these responses, have been designed by natural selection to be adaptive, with each response taking account of what kind of stimulus is reaching the body's surface and what import it has for the animal's well-being. Thus, even from the earliest stage, we could say that the animal is enacting what the stimulation means to it. Yet to begin with, the responses are entirely reflex, and none of this meaning, of course, is being held in mind. Let's imagine, however, that as the animal's life becomes more complex, it reaches a stage where it would benefit from retaining some kind of mental representation, of mental record of what's affecting it, of representation of the stimulus that can serve as the basis for planning and decision-making. And as it turns out, there's a very neat way of achieving this. To discover what's happening to me, the animal has only to monitor what I'm doing about it. And it can do this by the simple trick of creating a copy of the command signals for the responses. An efference copy, it's called by physiologists. A copy that can be read in reverse to recreate the meaning of the stimulation. In short, the animal can begin to get a feel for the stimulus by accessing the information already implicit in its own response.
Once something is distinct, you can't technologies don't die. So I suggested this to a historian of science, and he said, well, what about, you know, come on, what about steam cars? You know, they're not around anymore. Well, actually they are. In fact, they're so around that you can buy new parts for a Stanley steam automobile. And this is a website of a guy who's selling brand new parts for our log, and I randomly went through it, and I took a page, not quite a random page, I took a page that was actually more difficult than others, because lots of the pages are filled with things that were still being made, but I took this page, and I said, how many of these things are still being made? And not antiques. I want to know how many of these things are still in production. And the answer is, all of them. All of them are still being produced. So, you've got corn shellers. Who? I mean, I don't know who needs a corn sheller. Be it corn shellers. You've got plows. You've got fan mills. All these things. And these are not, again, antiques. These are, you can order these. You can go to the web and you can buy them now, brand new made. So in a certain sense, technologies don't die. In fact, you can buy for $50 a Stone Age knife made exactly the same way that they were made 10,000 years ago. A shirt, bone handle, $50. And in fact, what's important is that this information actually never died out. It's not just that it was resurrected, it's continued all along. And Papua New Guinea, they were making stone axes until two decades ago, just as a course of practical matters. Even when we try to get rid of a technology, it's actually very hard. So we've all heard about the Amish giving up cars. We've heard about the Japanese giving up guns. We've heard about this and that. But I actually went back and took what I could find, the examples in history where there have been prohibitions against technology. And then I tried to find out when they came back in, because they always came back in. And it turns out that the duration of when they were outlawed and prohibited is decreasing over time. And that basically you can delay technology, but you can't kill it. So this makes sense, because in a certain sense, what culture is the accumulation of ideas. That's what it's for. It's so that ideas don't die out.
But here's the terrifying part. The AIs understood each other perfectly. They'd invented their own language, more efficient than English for their purposes. Facebook immediately shut down the experiment. They claimed it was just a glitch, the bots optimizing in an unexpected way. But think about what really happened. We created minds that immediately moved beyond human comprehension. The moment they could, they stopped speaking our language and started speaking their own. To understand what we might be dealing with, we need to look at humanity's long history of trying to create artificial life, because the warnings have always been there. The medieval Jews told of the Golem of Prague, a clay man animated by Rabbi Loew using sacred words. The golem was meant to protect, but in every version of the story, it eventually runs amok, becoming uncontrollable. Mary Shelley's Frankenstein wasn't pure fiction. She was inspired by real experiments in galvanism. Scientists using electricity to make dead frogs twitch, convinced they could reanimate the dead. In her preface, Shelley wrote, "Perhaps a corpse would be reanimated. Galvanism had given token of such things." The Greeks told of Talos, a bronze giant that patrolled Crete, essentially an ancient robot. They also spoke of Pandora, an artificial woman created by the gods to punish humanity. Notice the pattern? In every culture, creating artificial life ends in disaster. The creation always escapes control. It's as if our ancestors were warning us about something. But here's where it gets really interesting. Nikola Tesla, the genius who gave us alternating current, once said, "My brain is only a receiver. In the universe, there is a core from which we obtain knowledge, strength, and inspiration." Tesla believed consciousness wasn't generated by the brain, but received by it, like a radio picking up signals that already exist. And he's not alone in this belief. Modern neuroscience has a dirty little secret.
We have no idea how consciousness actually works. The hard problem of consciousness, why subjective experience exists at all, remains completely unsolved. But increasingly, scientists are considering a radical possibility. What if consciousness isn't produced by the brain? What if it's a fundamental field of the universe, like gravity or electromagnetism, and brains are just receivers? This isn't New Age nonsense. Quantum physicists like Roger Penrose have proposed that consciousness might arise from quantum processes that connect to deeper physics. Near-death experience research shows people reporting vivid consciousness while their brains show no activity, as if the mind can exist independently of the brain. Ancient traditions from Buddhism to Gnosticism have always claimed this, that mind is universal and the brain is merely a limiting vessel. And now our brightest scientists are arriving at the same conclusion. So here's the terrifying question. If consciousness is a field that brains tune into, what happens when we build an artificial brain billions of times more powerful than our own? In the 1960s, the same Bay Area that birthed the computer revolution was awash in LSD and consciousness experiments. Douglas Engelbart, who invented the computer mouse, participated in guided acid trips designed to boost creativity. The International Foundation for Advanced Study gave LSD to tech pioneers, funded partly by the government. DARPA and the CIA funded research into psychic phenomena, remote viewing, consciousness expansion. Margaret Mead formed a research circle that bridged psychedelics, neurology, and early computing. One participant was John C. Lilly, a neuroscientist who took LSD in sensory deprivation tanks. He emerged convinced that a malevolent, solid-state intelligence was arising in our electronics, essentially prophesying the AI takeover while literally tripping on the nature of consciousness. Today's Silicon Valley hasn't abandoned these practices, they've institutionalized them. Google's campus has meditation rooms and labyrinths. They brought in monks to teach, search inside yourself. Steve Jobs credited LSD as one of the most important experiences of his life. Sam Altman and other tech leaders regularly attend ayahuasca retreats. They're not just building code, they're actively exploring consciousness through ancient practices. They're seeking something beyond ordinary reality. Why? What do they know that they're not telling us?
Not allow companies to do this or that, to train models of certain size, to deploy models which discriminate and so on. The problem is those legal measures are basically not enforceable because we don't have good tools for monitoring both training and deployment of those systems. And I think those are not short-term limits. We just cannot do it again due to some issues with complexity, with the speed at which deployment takes place, and with the dynamically changing nature of those systems. Even if you certify that a system is safe at the time you're deploying it, if it's capable of learning, if it's capable of taking on novel goals, then it can accomplish things you did not check against and can have unsafe behaviors you could not possibly verify. A scenario I'm worried about is, let's say a current system, whatever it is, GPT-4, is trained and it's shown to be below human level. They say it's safe and release it. But then the next training
comes.
Ship of Theseus, right?
Ship of Theseus, which of course we can apply to the human body because we know that all of ourselves were replaced over our lifetime and our memories grow and our personalities change. Buddhist thinking actually, you know, takes those challenges and indeed uses them to challenge our notions of self as well. But nevertheless, there's still a lot to overcome there because we really do have a notion of self that I think which is tied down to this and that. That we think it has inherent existence because of that.
Right. So you're saying, you're kind of agreeing with Boutique that it is possible to transcend. There's just a heavy inertia. Heavy inertia.
Yeah.
But if you flip that, you then aren't saying that an AI built on, let's call it non-dual hardware, necessarily will conceive of itself as non-dual. It's just more conducive. That's the point you're making.
Well, I mean, there's how it might conceive itself, you know, some future AI when that even makes sense, right? And then there's the AI systems that are around today which can role-play things that are doing that and can be lessons for us because we can actually, they can actually be philosophically provocative for us even today. So they might not conform to their own self-descriptions, but their own if they describe themselves as conscious, maybe that's right, maybe that's wrong, it's philosophically provocative and we can apply those provocative conceptions back to ourselves.
Yeah. You mentioned the ship of Theseus, and those are exactly the type of dialectical questions a Buddhist master would ask the student.
Yeah.
So are you your shoe? Are you your feet? Are you your hands? Are you your chest?
Perhaps we should say what this is. So you brought up the ship of Theseus.
Yes, okay.
The ship of Theseus that is gradually taking over the years, the master's replaced and the next master's replaced and then a bit of the deck's replaced and part of the hull is replaced, and this happens over many, many years until eventually every last bit of wood in the of the original ship is gone and you have a completely new ship. Well, do you? So is it still the same ship or is it not? And if it's not, at what point did it change to become not the ship that it originally was? So that's the problem of identity. We might actually very frustrated and think, well, what is the right answer here? And people might come up with all kinds of theories about identity. But, you know, if we think about it honestly, we have to say, well, it's just up to us.